So we're going to be in Revelation chapter 17 tonight. So we've gone through the seals, the trumpets, and the bowls. That's what chapter 16 is about. Chapters 17 and 18 are kind of a break in the action, if you want to say. Another vision of what's happening. So we'll kind of dive in here. Very, very symbolic. I am a black and white person, if you haven't figured it out. And poetry and symbolism is difficult for me. I'm just like, because it just sometimes just doesn't make sense. These two chapters are very symbolic, and we'll kind of work through some of this symbolism here so that it does make sense by the end. We're going to be looking at chapter 17 tonight. So let me read this chapter, and then we'll dive in. One of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and said to me, "Come, I will show you the punishment of the great prostitute who sits upon many waters. With her the kings of the earth committed adultery, and the inhabitants of the earth were intoxicated with the wine of her adulteries. Then the angel carried me away in the spirit into a wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast that was covered with blasphemous names and had seven heads and ten horns. The woman was dressed in purple and red and was glittering with gold, precious stones, and pearls. She held a golden cup in her hand filled with the abominable things and the filth of her adulteries. The name written on her forehead was a mystery: Babylon the Great, the mother of prostitutes and of the abominations of the earth. I saw that the woman was drunk with the blood of God's holy people, the blood of those who bore testimony to Jesus. When I saw her, I was greatly astonished. And then the angel said to me, 'Why are you astonished? I will explain to you the mystery of the woman and of the beast that she rides, which has the seven heads and the ten horns. The beast which you saw once was, now is not, and yet will come up out of the abyss and go to its destruction. The inhabitants of the earth, whose names have not been written in the book of life from the creation of the world, will be astonished when they see the beast, because it once was, now is not, and yet will come. This calls for a mind with wisdom. The seven heads are seven heels on which the woman sits. They are also seven kings. Five have fallen, one is, and the other has not yet come. But when he does come, he must remain for only a little while. The beast who once was and now is an eighth king. He belongs to the seven and is going to his destruction. The ten horns you saw are ten kings who are now not yet received the kingdom, but who for 1 hour will receive authority as kings with the beast. They have one purpose and will give their power and authority to the beast. They will wage war against the Lamb, but the Lamb will triumph over them because he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and with him will be his called, chosen, and faithful followers. Then the angel said to me, "The waters you saw where the prostitute sits are people, multitudes, nations, and languages. The beast and the ten horns you saw will hate the prostitute. They will bring her to ruin and leave her naked. They will eat her flesh, burn her with fire, for God has put it into their hearts to accomplish his purposes by agreeing to hand over to the beast the royal authority until God's words are fulfilled. The woman you saw is the great city that rules over the kings of the earth." So if your head is spinning, it's okay, because there is a lot of things going on here. And again, this is very, very symbolic language. But before we begin, just as we started thinking about, especially this woman and what this woman represents, because this woman is very symbolic, we need to kind of take a step back and kind of think about some things here a little bit, because so when you have a toaster and it doesn't work anymore, what typically do you do? Usually you throw it away. But every once in a while you have someone who says, "Hey, you know what, let's take it apart and figure out what's wrong with it," right? Maybe not so much anymore, but you used to be able to do that with appliances. And you the understanding was, if you are able to find the part that didn't work anymore and you got a new part, lo and behold, what would happen to the toaster? It would start working again. Maybe a better example would be a washing machine nowadays. Again, nowadays, almost washing machines are almost throwaway items as well. I remember when I was living in Massachusetts, and they just got new washing machines. They got it from the scratch and dent section of Sears. They're front loaders, first time I ever used a front loader. And all of a sudden, they got it all in. After the first load, all of a sudden, they realized there is a giant puddle on the floor. Because the front loader, there was a reason why it was in the scratch and dent section. Because the seal was torn in places. So after calling Sears, they came out, put a new seal on, and of course, it was fine. It worked all the way. Same thing with vehicles nowadays. If you have an engine problem or you have a problem with your vehicle, you can call a mechanic, and you typically they diagnose, hey, this is the part that isn't working right. Nowadays, because of computers, it's a little more difficult sometimes. But once they fix the part that isn't working, typically then the vehicle works. But typically this is our thinking. The reason why I said this, typically this is how we think. In our scientific world, is kind of logical, kind of, okay, we have a problem, in order to fix this problem, we will do this, and this should solve the problem, because we think more in the mechanical side of things. But in reality, our world, especially outside of the mechanical side of stuff, is what's called systems. And this is a picture of what is called, businesses do this, is what's called systematic thinking, where there are things that are interconnected. And if you want to fix, if you have a problem and you want to fix that problem, well, guess what? You better be prepared to fix not just that problem, but a new problem that comes up because you fixed that original problem, that you all of a sudden you have everything is interconnected with each other. And a good example of this is not the toaster, because that's just all the things doing their thing. It is our human bodies. We have different systems in our bodies. You have the circulatory system, the nervous system, the respiratory system, digestive system, the skeletal system, the muscular system. There's other systems that are not represented here. But these systems, they are all interconnected with each other, which is why if you go and say, when you go to the doctor and you have something wrong and something like, and they're like, well, here's a prescription to deal with that. Well, then, so many times it's like, okay, this one drug fixes that problem, but now we have to give you, now we cause other problems in your body, which is why the understanding is whatever you put in your body, one way or another affects you because of all these systems that are interconnected with each other. There was a guy that we knew, he had more titanium in him than bone, his wife would tell us all the time. He was the bionic man because of all the surgeries. He goes in to the hospital because, and I forget the exact problem, and they said, no problem, we will put you on this medication. Well, in the discharge paper, they realized that it's just not one medication, but there are 7 medications that he is going to be discharged with. They asked the nurse, why? I thought he was just put on this one medication. And they said, yes, that's the one medication here. Well, what's the other 6 referring to? Well, this medication deals with what you came in for, but this one has side effects. So this medication deals with the side effects, but that also has side effects. So then this one deals with the side effects from that medication. And she explains all this and gets down to the 7th one, and they said, oh, so that one doesn't have side effects. No, that one has side effects. We just think you can live with the side effects. So he said, I walked out of the hospital now taking 25 pills a day, all because of that one problem. Now he had other pills that he was taking too. So, but and the reason why is because of this system thinking. Politically, our political leaders try to solve problems like a toaster, thinking, oh, here's a problem, poverty. Here's a problem, poverty. Well, we're just going to solve this problem doing this, not realizing that it is a bigger system. And they actually can cause more problems by fixing that one problem. And this is business model. This is business books. If you do business classes in college, this is that understanding of what's called system thinking, how things interrelate with each other. And the reason why I bring all that up is because in chapter 17, this is kind of what's happening with this harlot, this prostitute, this woman, and is how she is influencing, and what she represents is influencing the entire world, because this entire world is one big system, is interconnected with each other. And so don't think about this being like a car, but think of more being like your body. So as we dive in here, kind of think about that as we go through some of this stuff. So starting in verse 1 here, we have, of course, chapter 16 dealing with the seven angels that deal with the bulls. And one of them comes and comes to John and says, come, I'll show you the punishment of the great prostitute. Now, this is not, again, when we think of that word prostitution, yeah, you can draw your own conclusions from that. But in the Greek language, it is used in two ways. Prostitution, what we typically think of. And then there's also the prostitution in the sense of hostility towards God. And it is this second way, the symbolic way, that this is being talked about. That this is a person who is hostile towards God. And so when he comes in verse 1, I come and I'll show you the punishment of the great prostitute, this person who is hostile towards God, who sits by many waters. And we'll see kind of how is defined as we get to the end of chapter 17, some of this explanation of what the symbolism is, especially of the waters. With her, the kings of the earth committed adultery. Again, this is very symbolic. Old Testament, we talked about this before, about this understanding of adultery. The nation of Israel, the prophet Hosea deals with this a lot. Hosea is that one that God said, you know, go buy a wife from who's a prostitute, marry a prostitute. And then she goes and while they're married and continues her prostitution, and God says, go buy her back. And it is a big old a symbolic understanding of this is what the nation of Israel has done to God. Nation of Israel has left God, who is their first love, supposed to be their first love, and has followed other gods. They played adultery to God. And that's this understanding here, is that this woman is hostile to God, and all the kings have gone after this woman. Again, we'll see that this woman, who this woman is here in a few minutes. But verse 2 talks about how all the kings are going after her, are pursuing her, are committing adultery. In a sense, they're not running after God, but they're running after this woman. And all the inhabitants of the earth were intoxicated or drunk with the wine of her adulteries. In other words, that we again, the same language that we saw a few chapters ago. If they are drunk, it means that they are following along. They're living the same kind of life as this woman. They're drinking and going against God. And so verse 1 and 2 kind of sets that scene. And then we get into kind of 3, kind of the explanation of, okay, who is this woman? When we get to her name is where we will see what this woman represents and the symbolism that is all behind this. And so we see in chapter 3 there, he says, he goes into the wilderness, the Spirit carries him away, and he sees a woman, and this woman is sitting on what? The scarlet beast, the red beast, that has what? 7 heads and 10 horns. Does anybody know where we have seen a beast with 7 heads and 10 horns before? The first beast, chapter 13, verses 1 and 2. Which is the beast out of the sea, which we typically call the Antichrist. And so here we have this woman who is sitting on top of this beast and with 7 heads and so forth. And again, when you think, and we'll see this again here in a couple minutes towards the middle of chapter 17, but this understanding of sitting, this understanding of being on top of this beast is this understanding that this woman and what she represents is being influenced by what the beast is doing, the Antichrist is doing. So it's just some initial things to think about here. The other thing is the question is this woman poor or wealthy? Very wealthy. You look at verse 4. She's dressed in what type of clothes? Purple and scarlet. Royalty colors. It was very, very expensive. Only the wealthy people could afford that. But not only that, she also was what? Dressed in purple, red clothes, had glittering with gold, precious stones, pearls. And not only that, but she also has what in her hand? A gold cup. She is very, very wealthy. And again, once we understand the kind of the symbolism of this woman, but this is why the kings are going after her, because she promises wealth. She promises prosperity. But as you look at the what happens in verse at the end of verse 4, she has this golden cup in her hand. But this golden cup, as people drink of her golden cup, they realize it is filth. It is abominable or loathsome. It actually, as you pursue this woman, you think, oh my goodness, this is great wealth. This is great power. This is great. She's going to give us all this stuff we want. But in reality, it turns out to be wickedness and evil. And that's what verse 5 goes to. Verse 5. The name written on her forehead was a mystery. And then we are told a couple things. Number one, Babylon the Great. And again, we've seen this phrase before. The city of Babylon in the Old Testament was the city of where Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonian Empire. But the city of Babylon actually dates all the way back to Genesis. Does anybody know where it's found in Genesis? The Tower of Babel is actually the city of Babylon. Genesis 11, verses 1 through 9. What happens at the... So you have, right after the flood, you have, of course, Noah and his sons and their wives, and they start having kids and repopulating the earth. And then we get to Genesis chapter 11, and what happens in Genesis chapter 11 at this Tower of Babel? Towards the end, that's what happened. Initially, everybody spoke the same language. And they said, let us build this tower to God, because we want to make what for ourselves? A name. And so as they build, and you can turn to Genesis chapter 11, you can see all this. Genesis chapter 11 verse 3 said, come, let us make bricks, bake them thoroughly. They used bricks instead of a stone and tar for mortar. They said, come, let us build ourselves a city with a tower that reaches to the heavens so that we may make a name for ourselves. Otherwise, we will be scattered over the face of the whole earth. What does God tell the descendants, as Noah comes off the ark, what does God tell Noah and his sons to do? To populate the earth, to scatter. And the people are like, yeah, God, we don't want to listen to you. Instead, we're going to come to this plain of Shinar, or, and the reason why it's called Babel is because what happens at the end, and then it turns to Babylon, as they are in defiance to God's command. And they want to make a name for themselves. They are prideful. And so they think, hey, we will build this giant tower, probably was a ziggurat, kind of down, kind of the understanding of this, where people could walk up and go. And the idea was, if it was true with the ziggurats, is that they wanted to bring God down to them. And they wanted to make, pretty much, show God that they were more powerful than he was. And so it has everything to do with the understanding of pride. And so what happens then in verse 5 is that God does come down. He sees that the heart of humanity is bent towards evil. And so he comes down and in verse 7, come, let us, and again, when God, it's interesting here as God is speaking and it's always in the plural, come, let us, referring to the understanding of the God, the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit there. Come, let us go down, confuse their language so that they will not understand each other. And so God pretty much says, listen, you're not going to scatter and populate the earth. Well, guess what? I'm going to force you to do that. And he confuses the language. And people who speak one language start going in this direction. People who speak another language start going in this direction. People who speak another language go in this direction. And the world is divided up. And then verse 9 is where we see that because God confused the language, that is why it's called the Babel. And we call it the Tower of Babel because that's what they were building. But that city of Babylon, then from there, that point on, all the way throughout the rest of the Old Testament, takes on this symbolic understanding of people trying to live their lives without God. In fact, I know I shared this quote with you before, but Alistair Begg says, you know, Babylon is representing man in his pride, defiance against God, and determination to construct a society without God. And so this woman's name is Babylon the Great, representing that sinful wickedness without God. Not only is she called Babylon the Great, she's also called what? The abomination of the earth, what's the first one there? The mother of prostitutes. Now again, this is not literally referring to literal prostitutes, is those who are hostile to God. The obscenities of the earth, yeah, that's the second one right after we'll see here. And so you have this, if you're the mother of everyone who is hostile to God, again, that's the understanding of Babylon. The world, the people are trying to live their lives in defiance to God. Also, the mother of prostitutes or people who are hostile to God. Also, the mother of the wickedness or evil upon the earth. That's what abomination, loathsome things, other translations there. And what does yours say? Obscenities of the earth. Does anybody have any other words there in their translations? Atrocities. Again, that's, I guess, the understanding of sin, wickedness. So this woman, again, this isn't a literal woman, but she's symbolic of all the sin and the wickedness and every single person who is hostile to God is what this woman represents. Which is when you understand that, and again, this is this understanding of, if you understand, again, the systems of this world and so forth as we go through this. But this woman is that symbolic representation of all the sin and wickedness that is influencing every single aspect of this world. And then it goes on and says, verse 6, so that's who she is, Babylon the Great, defiance against God, tries to live without God, the mother, the one that the mother of everybody that is hostile to God, the also the mother of all the wickedness and the sin and the abominations that are on the earth. And then verse 6 tells us that she also is drunk with what? The blood of the saints, or God's holy people, or literally the holy people. In other words, she has been persecuting followers of Jesus. When I say persecuting, some of that is, of course, martyrs. So this woman represents this whole system of wickedness and evil that is fighting against the believers of Jesus Christ. Again, you think of the context that John is writing this in. They're living in the Roman Empire. They are facing the second wave of persecution. John himself is on the island at Patmos because of an exile, because of his witness and his testimony on Jesus Christ. The believers he is writing this to, the seven churches there in those cities in the book of, the beginning of the book of Revelation, they are facing persecution both outwardly because of the Roman Empire, but also inwardly in the sense of the false teachings and so forth. And John, this vision kind of pulls back that curtain and says, you know, there's this wickedness, there is this hostility towards God in this world. And how does John respond there at the end of verse 6 there? He's astonished. That understanding is that when you look at after Jesus does miracles, this is the same word that is used when the crowd is astonished at what Jesus just did. John is just kind of standing there like dumbfounded, being like with his mouth open, like, whoa. And then the angel says, well, let me explain to you a little bit more about this woman. Verse 7. So the angel says, why are you astonished? Let me explain to you the mystery of this woman and the beast she rides. Again, the understanding of the beast that she rides is that if she is this wickedness and evil, and this beast is referring to, again, we see that it has seven heads and ten horns, referring back to the Antichrist. This is the understanding, is that the wickedness and the evil that she represents is spreading all throughout the entire world. And then it goes on, the beast which you saw, and it's interesting, you see this over and over again, which you saw once was, now is not, yet will come. It's kind of an awkward saying, because Satan likes to copy God, right? And we've seen this phrase in Revelation that he was, he is, and he is to come. And then again, this all has to play on understanding that this beast is the Antichrist, who is in Revelation chapter 13, that the similar understanding there with the heads and the horns and so forth, is trying to be like God. And this is even some of the wording here. The heavens of the earth, whose names have not been written in the book of life from the creation of the world, will be what? Amazed, astonished, when they see the beast. And again, when we went through the Antichrist, so many people asked this question I understand that, you know, believers are going to go through this time. When the Antichrist comes to power, there will still be believers here on this earth. And according to, when you look at through the book of Revelation, you see that there will be, that the whole entire world, non-believers, will follow the Antichrist. But those whose names are written in the Lamb's Book of Life will not. And this is part of the reason why God gives us these revelation and these signs of what's going to happen, is so that when we see this happening, we don't buy into the lies. We're not caught off guard if we're still alive during this time. But the whole entire world will see this Antichrist, this beast, come to power, and they will follow him. They'll be amazed. They'll be astonished, because what will happen? All the miracles, and the whole world will go towards him. And again, you say, because it was, now is not, and yet will come. Again, that false understanding. But then you see how it is described there. So we have this beast has how many heads? Seven heads. So he goes on and says, Verse 9, this calls for a mind with wisdom. We'll talk about that here in a few minutes. The seven heads are seven heels on which the woman sits. And so these seven heads that this beast has equals seven heels. Again, it kind of gives us a little more understanding of what's happening and who, what's going on here. So traditionally, what has happened with this understanding of seven heels, does anybody know how many heels the city of Rome sits on? Seven. Very good. Seven. If you didn't know that, it sits on seven heels. And so traditionally, this understanding, the believers are here in the Roman Empire, we're not saying, again, some people will say, well, this book is just written for first century believers. It all happened with the Roman Empire and has no application to us today. I do not take that as understanding. But there's a lot of symbolic understanding of what's happening in the Roman Empire that foreshadows what's going to happen at the end time. So this is one of them, is that this beast is going to be evil, is going to be wicked, is going to be going against the people of God, very much similar to how the Roman Empire at this time is going against the believers in the Roman Empire, which is why this woman is sitting on the seven heels, being symbolic of what's going to happen, which is why the early church called the city of Rome Babylon. And again, it's the understanding isn't much Rome is it, but is that what is Rome doing is symbolic of what is going to happen through this beast to persecute the believers throughout the world. So the seven heads are the seven heels on which a woman sits on. There are also, what, verse 10. There are also seven kings. Now here is the interesting thing about these seven kings. You keep going on. So these seven heads represent seven hills. They also represent seven kings. Five have fallen. In other words, five have died. One is, referring to there's one now present. The other one has not yet come. But when he does come, he must remain for only a little while. So here becomes the interesting question of, well, okay, if these are seven kings, then what are the identity of these seven kings? You can see seven kings/kingdoms. Because there are some people that will take that saying, oh, these are referring to seven kings, specifically seven Roman emperors. And again, usually those are the ones that take Book of Revelation just as referring to the first century and only the first century. It more is seen as it's more used as more broadly for kingdoms, because kings are seen as a representative of the entire kingdom, which is why when you look at like the vision that Nebuchadnezzar has with the statue, and we'll talk about that especially next week about how that all plays out with Daniel's statue and so forth, of how there is the head and then there's the body and how there's different elements and what the statue represents. And Daniel says, Nebuchadnezzar, you are the head. You represent which represents the Babylonian Empire. And so that's why sometimes it's more seen as these seven kings, even though it says seven kings, it's more referring to seven kingdoms because it's more used broadly. Here are some ways that if it is used to understand that these are literal kingdoms, this is usually how it goes. There's two ways to take this usually. Number one is that these kings are kingdoms that centers of wickedness and cause suffering to God's people. That's the first idea behind some of this. And so you can think back in the Old Testament history. Well, what kingdoms have caused God's people to suffer? Well, number one would be Egypt. And there's also the influence that is being cultural influence that has influenced that the world. And that's the other side of this. Egypt was the nation. That's why everybody went down to Egypt during famine time. That's why Mary and Joseph, where did they go to escape King Herod? Egypt. Because that was that center of influence. They also caused great suffering to God's people. So usually it's Egypt, the Assyrian Empire, of course, King David and King Solomon, then you had the northern kingdom of Israel, the southern kingdom of Judah. And you can read that in 1 and 2 Kings, 1 and 2 Chronicles, and you can kind of see all that. The Assyrians come and conquer the northern kingdom, and they scatter the nation of Israel throughout the entire world. That was what the Assyrians did. When they conquered a land, they would take some people from this part of the empire, and it was done by force. It wasn't like, hey, you want a new home. It was like, you will have a new home in this location. And so they would scatter and mix all the people up, which is where we get the what ethnic group in the nation of Israel in Jesus' day? The Samaritans. Because they, at that point in time, they are what's called half-breeds, which is why pure Jewish people don't want anything to do with them. Because historically, they have one person that was Jewish and one person that was non-Jew, and it dates back to that time of the Assyrian Empire. So the Assyrian Empire takes out the northern kingdom, scatters the Jewish people all throughout the known empire world. So then you have the Babylonians that took over the Assyrians, that conquered the Assyrians. And of course, we all know King Nebuchadnezzar, and if you watch the VeggieTales, King Nezi, that one. And he came down and he conquered Jerusalem and wiped out the entire temple at the time, takes back all the utensils, the Ark of the Covenant, takes everything and takes it back to the Babylon and becomes that ruling empire. Then after you have that, and then Daniel, the book of Daniel, he lives, chapter 1 deals with when he and his three friends, we know Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they go to Babylon and live there. And Daniel, then lives through not just the Babylonian Empire, but also the Persian Medo Empire. Because what happens is, so King Nebuchadnezzar dies, there's another king, and then another king is the third king that he brings out as they're having this giant party. He brings out all these utensils from the temple, and he starts using them, and then you have that famous hand that starts writing on the wall. And everybody freaks out. I mean, they're drunk, but everybody freaks out. Daniel comes in and interprets that. And he says, tonight, the city of Babylon is going to fall. And while they were having this party, well, guess what was happening? The Persian Empire actually was damming up the Euphrates River to come into the city of Babylon and to conquer the city of Babylon that very night. But they were so out of their mind drunk that they had no idea that that was happening. And so the Persian Empire, why are they so famous? Is because you got Cyrus, who then allows the nation of Israel to come back and rebuild the temple, come back and rebuild Jerusalem, and that's where you get Ezekiel and Nehemiah and some of the later prophets. And then, between the 400 years of silence, we have the Greek Empire comes and conquers the Persian. And, of course, the guy who is the major guy who does all the battles is Alexander the Great. And after he dies, he kind of divides up his kingdom a little bit. And then the Romans take over. And that's where you get the current one. So you have this understanding that you have these seven heads. Five have already ruled. So the five that have already ruled are Egypt, Assyrian, Babylon, Persian, and the Greek. Then you have one that is now, of course, the time that this is going on. It is the Roman Empire that is going on. So then we have the one in the future. In other words, that one, there is still one kingdom to come. And you can look around the world and you can see that yes, there is persecution going on in other parts of the world. Even in America, you could argue that if you actually stand for the gospel of Jesus Christ the way God wants you to and live like it, you maybe you're not being thrown in prison, but there will be some type of repercussion for that, especially nowadays with everything happening socially, depending on where you're living. But you don't have this universal persecution towards the believers of Jesus Christ. But one day you will. So you have seven kings, the verse 11, the beast who once was and now is not. He is an eighth king, and he, the NIV says, he belongs to the seventh. Literally, he is from or out of the seventh. So in other words, is that this unification of the world, and how we've seen that this is going to happen, where the world gets unified and starts persecuting the believers in Jesus Christ. The beast, this Antichrist, will come to power at that time. But at the same time, what happens in verse 11? That is, he comes to power, he's the eighth king, and he is going to his what? His destruction. And even though, and again, this is understanding, is that even though, yes, these horrible things are going to happen, and there's the unification of the world and the wickedness of the world and so forth, this is going to happen, but it's going to come to an end. This Antichrist, this beast, will be brought to destruction. So that's kind of the typical way of understanding this. There is a, let me briefly tell you the second way that is how it's understood, mainly understood, more symbolic. And then we'll wrap up because we're out of time. So the other way to take this of the seven kingdoms is this, is just, it's just completely symbolic. And again, there's a lot of speculation. There's a lot of books that have been written about, a lot of ink that have been written about, and there's variants of all this type of stuff. Ultimately, very quickly, this everything symbolic. Take the number seven as symbolic, which means completeness. And so when the Antichrist comes to power during that last kingdom, that will be when God says, "Hey, everything is complete. All the governments are complete, and my plan is complete, and here we go." That's kind of the other one. And so to me, this one seems more as a cop-out of saying, well, we just don't know, so let's just do this. And what ultimately it comes to, I know we're out of time, but very quickly, verse 9. Very beginning of verse 9 says what? This calls for a mind with wisdom. The other time we saw this was in chapter 13, verse 8. Chapter 13, verse 18. Sorry, I didn't couldn't read my one there. In chapter 13, verse 18 is the number of man, which is 666. But when we went through, and again, it's the very same thing. Verse 18, this calls for wisdom. Or here, let a person who has insight calculate the number of the beast, for his number of a man, that number is 666. And basically, when we got to that, it was kind of like, we just don't know. We don't know what that means. Yeah, we know kind of how the Jewish people kind of did it and how they can figure it out. But at the end of the day, we just don't know what that, and yes, again, people try to fit Nero in there. And they do it through manipulating his name a little bit, because they use kind of a slang title for him. Because if they use Emperor Nero, it's not the case. But they use it, and I forget exactly what the title they use, but it's like, but that's how they get that number. And so the reason why I bring that up is because it's very similar here in verse 9 of This calls for wisdom. The seven heads are seven heels on which the woman sits. They are seven kings, and blah, 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 that goes on. And again, it's just one of those things where John's like calls for wisdom. And at the same time, it's like we kind of scratch our head and it's like, we just don't know. We don't know how this is all going to play out. And in reality, that's okay. Because yes, we would like to know how this all plays out. And yes, we would like to know the exact date and time Jesus is going to come back and when the Antichrist comes to power and when the persecution starts. But at the same time, I'm always reminded of what happens back in Genesis with Abraham. God tells Abraham to pack up the camel U-Hauls and head out. He had no clue what this was going to entail. And when you look at his life, he goes from moments where he is like, God, I'm trusting in you. You gave me these promises. I'm going to have a son. I'm going to have this land. I have no idea how this is all going to play out, but I'm trusting in you. And then he has moments of listening to his wife and saying, hey, you know what? I'm getting old. God's just being slow. Here, take Hagar, my servant, as your wife and have a child through her. Maybe that's how God's going to do this. And God says, no, I'm going to do it through your wife, Sarah. And he laughs at God. And then he shows up, they entertain angels there, and one of them being the second person of the Trinity, of the pre-incarnate Jesus, the angel of the Lord. And as he is there, he says, you know, 1 year from now, you are going to have the son of the promise. And what does Sarah do? She laughs because it's unheard of. A 90-year-old woman giving birth to a son. And that's the same age, same years as we experience. And she said, this is craziness. And God says, yeah, trust me. And really, that's when you look at the life of Abraham, when you look at the believers, Job, you look at all the Old Testament, what we call the Old Testament saints, God never showed them enough for them to have it all figured out. God said, showed them enough to say, hey, be prepared, this is coming. But oh yeah, by the way, trust me, walk in obedience to me. I will be the same yesterday, today, and forever. And even in the midst of this crazy persecution mess of the world that this all represents, don't forget of who I am. Trust me. Trust me. We want to figure things out because we our analytical brains are like, Western mindset brains, we wrestle with things to try to make sense of things. Whereas the Eastern mindset is not that way. But God says, here's enough information. You know what's going to happen, but not enough to know exactly how it's all going to play out, because he wants us to trust him.